Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Jaws of Justice Radio hopes you will take the time today, Memorial Day, to honor those who have given their life to protect the freedoms we all enjoy in the USA. Please attend one of the many ceremonies around town or visit the grave of a loved one that has made the sacrifice. On today's broadcast, host Melvin Merritt talks with Kevin Jamison of Veterans Community Project about their Tiny Homes Project for veterans. Then, in the second half, I will talk with Samantha Jeffers of Warrior's Best Friend about their work training service dogs with and for veterans. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast, and as always, the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is Melvin and his guest.
I'm going to be talking with Mr. Kevin Jamison, and he is part of the Veterans Community Project. He grew up in Kansas City area, attending school at Park Hill and graduating from Lawson High School. Upon graduation, Kevin joined the United States Marine Corps in 1990. Kevin became Chief Warrant Officer in 1998 and served as a Ground Electronic Warfare Slice Signal Intelligence Officer. Kevin served in Operation Uphold Democracy in Hayes in 1994, Operation Civil Wake in Albania in 1997, and served three tours in Iraq before retiring from the Marines in 2010. After obtaining a BS degree in social psychology from Park University, Kevin took a job at a local homeless shelter in Kansas City, getting veterans off of the streets. After several months of working with veterans and observing the numbers of veterans left on the streets, Kevin joined up with other veterans to form Veterans Community Project in an effort to find a better way to serve homeless veterans. Veterans Community Project has an established goal of ending veterans' homelessness in Kansas City. I'd like to welcome Kevin right now to our show this morning. And it's pretty good that we're having it because of the fact that this is Veterans Day. And so I'm proud to sit in the studio with you, and being a veteran myself, and you being a veteran, and you picked up this baton, which I have looked on the website, and I think it's just awesome what you're doing in your organization. Tell us a little bit. Actually, the first thing I wanted to ask is, why did you start the Veterans Community Project?
Quite simply, we started it because we were working with so many veterans, and there were so many problems, and it seemed like the social service system, there were gaps that we identified, and in Kansas City, you know, and every community and how they serve the homeless is different, is what I've learned as we've been doing this. And so we were just identifying gaps and these gaps in services, and for various, every program has a different definition of veteran. So, you know, some programs, it's, you know, you have to serve a certain amount of time to qualify for VA services. You have to have a certain level of discharge. So all these programs had different levels, and all these different levels of service qualifications created barriers for other veterans to not access these services they needed. And we're discovering that some of these homeless veterans that were still out there, and some of these veterans that weren't getting the help and the services they needed, we discovered that we needed to do something different to serve them.
So why did you choose tiny houses?
Why did we choose tiny houses? Well, we didn't in the beginning. We were actually looking at like buying an old high school, like Westport High School. I remember we were looking at that. And we had always wanted to promote independent living. Mm-hmm. That's what we were doing, you know, we wanted to take it from isolation and keep them where they were controlling their environment.
Sure.
And then keep them in an isolated environment. So we're always about private living. We came across tiny houses after meeting with City Councilwoman Teresa Lohr. And she suggested, hey, why don't you guys look at tiny houses? Wasn't even a thought to us. And when we went and looked at it, one of the co-founders, Chris, he's the CEO of Veterans Community Project. He looked at it from the perspective financially, you know, how much would it cost and to construct and things like that. And I looked at it from a social service perspective. And when we came back to the table about a week to 2 weeks later, it just made sense. We could build one of these homes for our best guess in the beginning was we could build them for about $15,000 and then, and the ability of what we could do with them and how we could place them. And then we looked at, you know, we're like, wow, you could scale this to any size. And we, so we could create a community of veterans living together and that they had independent living. And then I looked at it from the social service perspective. One of my problems was I take a veteran from the streets, try to put them in a homeless shelter to stabilize them. Well, you know, the homeless shelters, they're very ultra socialized environment. Mm-hmm. It's group living. So you take someone that's living in isolation and controlling their situation, you put them in a group living where it's almost institutional and they lack a lot of control, mm-hmm. and they don't do very well. So I would put a vet in the homeless shelter and then, you know, a day or two later, he might take a shower, take a nap, or get some sleep, and then he would be gone the next day, and I'd have to go right back out on the streets and find him. So what the, you know, that independent living does, you take them from the streets where they're controlling their environment, you can place them in a place where they can control their environment, how they socialize as well, and then you can start to work with them to recover from homelessness.
I had an opportunity to look at your website and saw some of the houses that you had built, and they are like state-of-the-art type of homes.
Well, yeah,
with a flat screen TV on the wall.
Yes.
And it's nice. Matter of fact, I was interested in getting one.
Well, see, that was our, you know, that was another problem we had when mm-hmm. we looked at what how the veterans were being served and how they're being treated. You know, we're looking at some of the different types of shelters and things like that. We wanted, you know, I couldn't blame some of those guys for wanting to come off the streets because mm-hmm. of some of the environments they're going to be placed in, and some of the places where they were being housed, you know, were not the best environments. I wanted to give them something that I would live in, and that's our whole thing. We treat veterans the way we want to be treated,
right?
You know, because it's a fine line between a veteran that's struggling and a veteran that's not, and we wanted to be able to help those guys, and we wanted to give them an incentive, a reason to come off the streets, a reason, you know, to be helped. And you know, if you provide dignity and respect, which is what we do, we believe that people act the way you
want to be treated.
Yeah.
And absolutely. And I like what your mission statement is that we determined to make a difference in the lives of homeless veterans accomplished only by community to community. And usually I think what you're saying is that you go after any veteran that have taken the oath.
Yes.
We
basically, our definition of veteran is anyone that raised their hand to take an oath.
That's what I'm looking
to protect and defend the Constitution.
Right.
And the reason why is because it's an inclusive term. Mm-hmm. It's a very clear definition of veteran. We're paying respect to that. Those people that at one time in their life were willing to stand up and say, yes, I will defend our country.
Tell me this: what do you guys mean when you say community for community?
Because we believe that community has many different terms, and you know, when we set out, as defining ourselves as an organization, mm-hmm. We decided that we wanted to bring the veteran community together to attack homelessness, and the community for the community is we also want to engage the community and veteran community problems. And mm-hmm. we want to be an avenue for people to attack veteran homelessness. So we want to bring the community of veterans together to attack the problem.
Right.
We also want to be a way for the community to come together for this problem. Because we do not believe the government is the answer. Because if the government was the answer, it should have been solved a long time ago.
And besides, the government is overlooking some of the veterans. That's one of the reasons why they're slipping through the cracks, and it took people like yourself to step up to the plate and recognize this. And I noticed that most visibility is seen or shown on men. What about women?
There are homeless female veterans in Kansas City as well, where I've worked with several. The population is usually about my experience is like 10 to 15% of the homeless population of veterans are female.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have an answer as to why that is. I don't know how well it correlates to the, you know, percentages of the service, but
sure.
there are female homeless veterans, and they, you know, and our definition of veteran is asexual. You know, it's male or female. We'll serve any homeless veteran.
So as a percentage, how many women are connected to your tiny homes?
Well, we're not serving anyone right now. We won't be housing veterans until probably October timeframe because of sewers. We've got to put sewers in on our property. Right now, we don't tell most of the homeless veterans that we're working with on the streets right now. We don't tell them they're getting a home. We don't want to make any promise, because what if something goes wrong?
Right.
And then we're delayed again. We want these veterans that are out there working with existing programs, we want them to try to get off the streets now. So we're working with them, encouraging them to utilize existing programs. But in the meantime, you know, we're coming. And as soon as we're ready, we're going to go get them.
And from my understanding, that you guys are focusing more on those that maybe do not qualify with other programs.
Exactly. Our goal for our program is to get a veteran off the streets and get them into housing.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to undercut or undermine any of the existing programs that are out there, but we want to prepare the veteran to better utilize them.
Mm-hmm.
So we want the veteran to understand, when you're going through a VA emergency housing program, or if you're going through a VA HUD-VASH program, we want them to understand what that entails, and we want to prepare them for that program so that they can best utilize that program to set them up for long-term success. As well as some of these other programs that are out there, we want to educate them on that. We want to prepare them for what going in that program means. Meanwhile, we designed our program to serve veterans that don't qualify for these other programs. So, you know, the guys that qualify for these other programs, they'll probably only stay with us 3 to 6 months, where the guys that need our program are going to be there longer, because
right.
they're the guys that have been on the streets for a longer time.
I'm glad you mentioned programs. So what is this program is all about, as relate to when they come into your program?
When they come into our program, our goal is the first housing barrier. The only housing barrier they will have to be with us is to take the key out of our hand and get in our vehicle,
mm-hmm.
and take all their stuff. And then we put them into a home, and they will be there for about 2 weeks, and we allow them to adjust. We allow them to stabilize. And then what we do is we begin working with them. And we, during that stabilization period, we're looking at the veteran. We're trying to assess, you know, what are some of the symptoms and causes of their homelessness? And then we're trying to provide all the services that they will need to remedy them,
sure.
whether it's a mental health, whether it's addiction, whether it's trauma and counseling, what financial education, employment. We're going to take social problems. We're going to take on any problem they have, and we're going to be using the military culture to help attack this problem. That's how we're connecting with the veteran. Veterans respond when, you know, sometimes it's really interesting, you know, when we are in our building, we're working with veterans, and we ask them what rank they were, and we start talking to them, and they start reconnecting with their, you know, their military service, and you kind of see some changes start to click
sure,
with them.
Sure.
And so, yeah.
And I kind of, you know, I'm looking at, you know, especially when you're having problems with veterans as it relate to PTSD,
yes.
and some of them are severely bipolar. And how do you deal with some of those individuals, or do you just connect them to other agencies?
That's our plan is pretty simple. Is we leverage community agencies, because we want to partner with agencies. We
sure.
don't want to compete. The other thing that we do is we're building a community center on there where volunteers can come and provide those services. So we have different therapists and psychologists that are volunteering their time to donate to help the veterans. But recovery from trauma is ingrained in every aspect of our program, even into the design of the house. Windows on one side of the house, the bed tucked in a corner where they can't be seen by a window. The bathroom has a sliding door, and it doesn't need that. The homes are going to be arranged where the windows can't see into each other. Community gardens on our property that are just, you know, more or less for therapy. We also have.
So in other words, you encourage the veterans to work their own gardens and stuff like that.
Right. Whatever the veteran, we want to provide like any type of, for trauma recovery mm-hmm. from post-traumatic stress, you don't know what a veteran will connect with and what works for them. a lot of us, we all know people that have struggled from post-traumatic stress, mm-hmm. and all of us connected with different ways of recovery. One of my friends has a service dog. For me, I went through a different type of therapy that was called prolonged exposure therapy that really helped me a lot. So there's different ways. So we want to be able to provide access to all these different programs, the equine therapy, you know, we want to, you know, the fly fishing therapy, healing waters organization. Right. We want to partner with organizations like that to give the veteran almost like a menu of experiences to choose from. And then whatever they connect with, whatever helps them the most, we then encourage them and we stand beside them and guide them through that. Mm-hmm. It also helps when you have a community of people that have a shared experience.
Sure. How are you connecting with the medical community?
The medical community, some of that's a challenge, but we're actually going to have an examination room in there, and we're looking for doctors all the time to come out and donate their time. I know we have some nurse practitioners. We also have some nurses that want to come out and work with the veterans, and then just connect them with the existing by getting them jobs. If they don't have jobs, getting them the employment they need, and then if they can't get a job, maybe they're disabled, then connecting them, making sure they have their disability, they have their Medicaid and everything in line. And so the goal is to set them up for success. Completely our goal is to set them up for a housing situation where all their problems may not be solved, but they're manageable.
Mm-hmm.
And then they always have us. We'll never leave them. They can always come back to us and talk to us, and we'll always be there with them.
So what I'm hearing is that it's actually still on the drawing board in some areas.
Oh, yeah. We're still developing our program of services, because as more people are volunteering to help, and they're offering different, we're learning about new different types of services. We're learning about new therapies. And, you know, the cool thing about Kansas City is there's like a lot of great programs here, a lot of unique nonprofits
this
in the
city,
that have stepped up and offered to help us. And then trying to find a way to integrate all that into our program, so our program is constantly expanding and evolving.
Speaking of volunteers, how can a person get in touch with you or your organization because they might be interested in volunteering their services?
Yeah, all they have to do is they can go to our website, which is veteranscommunityproject.org. They can sign up to volunteer. They can donate on there. The other thing is, or they could send an email to volunteer@vcp-kc.org. Or they can, whenever we're at an event, they can come up and talk to us, and we usually have a sign-up sheet at an event.
Sure, that sounds good. Now, how did you come about getting property for placing all of this?
Well, on November 10th, which was the Marine Corps birthday of 2015, the first person we set up a meeting with was Mayor Sly James. And he's a Marine. So I was a Marine, and, you know, it's a Marine Corps birthday.
Yeah.
We kind of planned that pretty well, unexpectedly. But we met with Mayor James, and we explained to him our plan. And at that time, we were only going to do 30 houses. You know, we kind of didn't have property or anything. And, you know, we just presented our plan to the mayor, and he was like, you know, I'll be glad to help you. And his office connected us with the City Land Bank. And from that, we began searching for property. And then we found a property. The city would have donated to us if we asked, but
sure.
The problem with getting the land donated was we have not been able to be rezoned for what we're doing.
Mm.
And so we bought the property in February of last year.
Do you have to have that rezoned?
It's already been rezoned.
It's been rezoned.
And when it got rezoned, we became the first organization and the first city in the United States to be rezoned in city limits for a village of tiny houses, which is significant because that hasn't been done before. All these tiny house villages you see, most of them are outside of city limits, or they have these temporary legal permits from the city. They can't operate permanently.
Mm.
So for us, we wanted to do it right. Our homes are built to code and they're inspected. They're insulated. They're built to the same standards most people's homes are. They're going to be on foundations. They're going to be connected to city sewer, water, and utilities. It was a huge victory for us and for the city,
mm-hmm.
and to establish a model. You know, somebody to be able to do something to affect change, it takes people stepping up, and I can't say enough about what the city government did for us.
And you know, I heard that where you have pot, collaborated with other organizations, but what other organizations have you collaborated with? Because I noticed something on your website that, you know, that you collaborated with, especially in the heating system or something.
Right. Yeah. Oh, well, we have United Heating and Cooling. They provide all of our plumbing services to each home, and they do it for free. They provide the labor and the materials. Teague Electric provides all of the wiring for the homes, and they've even helped us on our property. Those are two of their biggest partners, but we also have Team Rubicon. They come out and volunteer. Team RWB and the VFWs and the American Legions have supported us tremendously. Some of the posts that have gone above and beyond. One of the posts that was my favorite is the Lee Summit VFW Auxiliary post. Mm-hmm. You know, they raised enough money to sponsor a house, and they sponsored a house for us. And I couldn't say enough.
I know we're not, you know, giving out any advertising, but they need a shout out too. And I noticed on your website, Mitsubishi. Assisting you.
At Mitsubishi Electric, they donated all of our heating and cooling systems. I wish I could sit here and fill up the next 2 hours talking about all of the partners and the great organizations that have supported us. And, you know, I apologize to anybody that I'm not hitting right now because, I mean, the one thing that we have that we're lucky is ever since we've announced our plans, we've received nothing but support from the community. Mm. Every organization, every business, every group I presented to, nobody said no. Everybody's tried to get involved in some way or another. And it's been really cool because we have kids, high school kids, making paintings for us. And we have a house full of paintings from a high school art class that the veterans, you know, they want to do that for vets. We have kids that write letters for the veterans. So when the veteran goes in their home, there's going to be hundreds of letters everywhere thanking them for their service and welcoming them to their home.
I understand that you're going to be doing some expansion. I know we talked about a lot of different things in terms of expansion.
But it was kind of interesting on, you know, May 1st, we were just, you know, we were four or five guys that were had come up with this plan. And we had bought the land, and we had seen some Facebook comments about you're putting vets in sheds, you're doing this and saying we were disrespecting them. So we built a home to show people what we were doing. And when we cut that ribbon on that home, our lives changed. Mm. And it kind of, our story went international. And from that time on, the people that get a hold of us from cities all across America, there's over 500 cities across America that have reached out to us and said, how can we do this in our town? How did you do this? How are you able to do this? And we've tried to help everyone we can, but expansion is, you know, was always kind of in our mindset. Like if we do succeed here, how do we take it to other cities? So that's been a focus of ours as we've been going along, we've been capturing it. And the reason why is this established a model. And when you have a model, you can replicate it. So right now we are looking at other cities, but we want to finish and refine what's going on in Kansas City first. We have to finish here because if we don't get it right here, then what's the point of taking it anywhere else? So we want to perfect it here.
And I'm glad you said that because my understanding is that this has been done somewhere else.
As far as I know, it hasn't. There are tiny house villages around other places that are serving the homeless population. I know there's one in Austin. I think it's called Fishes and Loaves. Mm-hmm. There's one in Oregon. There's one in Seattle. We actually went up to the one in Seattle and looked at it. And the homes were side by side.
Right.
None of them were insulated. They had no plumbing. The electricity was run through a series of connected extension cords.
Wow.
And they had 80-something people living in 28 homes. 28 of the residents were children. And it was not the conditions that we are creating. We want to create an environment, a community that's oriented toward recovery from homelessness, not a stopgap. We don't want to try to be a stopgap. We don't want to try to be a temporary shelter. We want to try to be part of moving people towards recovery.
Yeah, that's great. In the studio with me is Mr. Kevin Jamerson. He's the chief operator, operation officer, and co-founder of Veterans Community Project. And we're running out a little bit out of time.
That's
so
fine.
Real quickly, give us your information in case anyone might be interested in contacting you.
Sure. If they are interested in contacting us, they can basically send an email to info@VCP-KC-KansasCity.org.
So that's great. Now, tell us a little bit real quickly. I don't know how much time we got left. And for my engineer, he's talking about he held up one finger. So so I think it's just right on time that you gave the information. And I'm hoping that you guys will keep on keeping on, because I think it's a dynamite and excellent idea that you guys have come up with for the homeless veterans. So our applaud is out to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service. Thank you to all the veterans. Yeah, thank you. Thank you to all the veterans that's listening to us. And we just hope and pray that you have a great, great day.
Now, the calendar for May 29th. The Heart of America Stand Down has been giving a hand up to KC's homeless veterans since 1993. This year's event will be Friday, June 2nd, from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. at St. Michael's Veterans Place, 3838 Chelsea, KCMO. This one-day event will give homeless veterans some of the short and long-term resources needed to start rebuilding their lives. If you would like to find out more or volunteer, check out kcstanddown.org or call Bob Wachter at 773-850-9938 or by emailing bob@kcstanddown.org. The Cross Border Network will have their monthly meeting Monday, June 5th, at the Kauffman Foundation Conference Center, 4801 Rock Hill Road, KCMO. The board meeting will be at 6:30 p.m., general meeting at 7:30 p.m. Come and learn about the Inspector General's report on the Ahas massacre by the USDEA and Honduran police. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn, for sitting in for Beth Pike. Next week on Jaws of Justice Radio, it is pledge drive time. And we sincerely hope you will tune in and consider donating to KKFI and Jaws of Justice Radio. We have brought you voices from death row, those struggling to survive after incarceration, and those trying to survive and avoid incarceration, as well as police, judges, wardens, and so much more. We hope you find our broadcast of value, and again urge you to tune in and donate next week when host Craig LeBeau talks with author Lance LaRusso about why some police feel under attack from the communities they are charged with protecting. Coming up next is myself and my guest, Samantha Jeffers of Warrior's Best Friend. And we have a little bit of a switch up here. Today we're actually going to be talking to Joe Jeffers, Samantha's father. But while I was trying to write an introduction for this, I was kind of struggling with it, and I finally decided to just let them tell their story themselves, because they did it a lot better than I would have. So I'm going to read this little bit from the website for Warrior's Best Friend. Since the attacks of September 11, 2001, over 2 million troops have been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. As these men and women return home, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and traumatic brain injury, TBI, have emerged as signature injuries among our newest generation of soldiers. Medical studies prove that service dogs can help speed up the recovery of a soldier with PTSD and TBI both physically and emotionally. Unfortunately, many wounded soldiers have to wait years to receive a service dog. Warrior's Best Friend's mission is to provide critically needed service dogs free of cost for our veterans and their families. And in doing so, WBF saves two lives in the process. They adopt and train homeless canines to grant wounded soldiers the gift of greater self-sufficiency through emotional and physical independence, empowering men and women to lead a free and active lifestyle. This is Jeff Humfeld, and with me today is Joe Jeffers of Warrior's Best Friend. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's see. Warrior's Best Friend is a little bit different in this field in that you're a family business. It's a labor of love, so to say, but it's also a family thing. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your family and how you got into this, and also tell us about this the farm that you know your facility sits on.
Okay. My side of the family is mainly Air Force for many generations. My wife's side is Navy for generations. And so I come from a strong military background. I have never served myself, but had a great passion for animals and, of course, the military. And after selling a company and having some time to figure out what I wanted to do going forward in life, I decided to marry the two, helping homeless dogs benefit soldiers who had made incredible sacrifices. So it is a passion that my entire family is involved in. I have my youngest daughter, who is our lead trainer, and she trained for years to be an apprentice as a dog trainer, and now we do that here in Kansas City. My oldest daughter is director of marketing. My wife does a lot of our content on our website, and of course, I am president and founder. My mother does a great deal of work with our organization. We just, the whole family got involved in this. And as far as our property, in 2012, we started. We did 2 to 3 years of fostering our dogs. We had people that would keep the dogs for us, and of course then we would go out and train them. And then in 2016 we finally had the ability to build our temporary facility on land that's been in my family since the 1850s. We have 64 acres that's very close to the Liberty North High School. We are in Kansas City, and on that property we have built a training facility that houses the dogs that we had in foster care. And we're already working on expanding that facility to much, much larger. Our ultimate goal is to place 72 service dogs each year free of charge to veterans nationally, but mostly here in the Midwest.
All right. I think right now you're doing somewhere around 12 a year?
We are on track right now for 12 this year. That was our goal. We actually might do more than that. We might get closer to 14 this year. But with the capacity, the space that we have, that's just about the maximum that we can do without expanding the facility larger.
Okay. The most important component here in all of this are the veterans and the dogs.
Yeah.
So how does a veteran get involved? Do you go strictly through the VA and you know, do they have a list or do they, you know, veterans just find your organization and apply directly? Or
That's a great question. The generally soldiers who are suffering from PTSD or traumatic brain injury have trouble reaching out, either they, you know, for whatever issue. Most of our referrals come from family members. We have calls from mothers and fathers who call us and say, I think my son or my daughter could benefit from a service dog. Or most of the time, I would say 85 to 90% of the time, a person's psychologist or psychiatrist will recommend that their client get a service dog. So that's generally how we do that. Occasionally, we do have soldiers that reach out to us directly, but generally it's through a loved one or through the VA.
You know, what you just said there made me think of something else. Have you ever had someone who came back and they had a family dog that mm-hmm. they were very close with and came to you and said, you know, can you train my dog?
We get that all the time, and the answer is no. It sounds very cold, but trust me, after a dog has bonded with a person, it becomes extremely difficult to then train that dog to accept commands from that person. You know, by then they've already bonded and they kind of buddied up and they're like, you can't tell me really what to do here. And so it's difficult to really teach the dogs the commands that they need in order to fulfill the needs that the veteran needs. Yeah.
Okay, you do something very different than most mm-hmm. places. Most places use dogs that are bred, mm-hmm. you know, and raised to be service dogs, so to say. But you do something a little bit different. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you obtain the dogs and, you know, how you train them a little bit.
Sure. Well, half of our passion is finding a great home for these deserving homeless dogs. And so we travel to animal shelters throughout the Midwest, Texas, Kansas, Missouri, Florida. We locate dogs that are in shelters. We look at about 500 dogs to find one candidate. Now, we have physical characteristics that we're looking for. As an example, 85% of our soldiers have physical combat wounds. So they have nerve damage, traumatic brain injury, spinal damage, possibly a lost limb. And so they need a very large dog to provide stability, brace to help them get out of a chair or off of a bed. So all of our dogs have to be 23 inches high. They have to be over 8 years or 8 months old. And that's because they've got most of the puppy out of them and they can start taking instruction at that point, but less than a year old or year and a half old, so that they can have a long service life. Then you get into just temperament. We have soldiers that come into our program that are less active. Some are more active. So we try to locate dogs that are have a lot of energy, but at the same time, not so much it's difficult to receive instruction. So it takes our instructor, our evaluator, once she thinks she found the perfect dog, another 30 to 45 minutes of really kind of putting them through their paces at the shelter. But once we make the commitment to take the dog, it's brought here to Kansas City. The dog is trained for 5 to 8 months. It is taught 25 commands. When the dog masters those commands, it is given the ADI certification test, which is Assistance Dog International Test. And then at that point, if the dog passes the test, we make it available to be placed with a soldier for free. And then that's kind of where the second half of our business comes in, which is finding soldiers that can benefit from services that our dogs can provide.
Well, you train the dogs, but then once the dogs are trained, you have to pair them and then train the veteran. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So our dogs, based on their temperament, their activity level, size, just personalities, we match those dogs with soldiers who need that type of a dog. And so the dog is 100% trained when the soldier arrives here in Kansas City. We pay for the soldier's hotel, their food, their activities, transportation, obviously provide the dog for free, but really it's at no cost. So they will come to Kansas City for 9 days and train with their dog during that period of time. So they get picked up first thing in the morning. They go to breakfast, lunch, dinner. They go to activities. They go to malls, the Royals games, bowling, really anything that any type of activity that a soldier would want to go out and do. We teach that veteran how to handle their service dog in that situation.
Okay. What happens when a veteran comes in and they train with a dog and they take a dog and things just don't work out in the end? What happens to the dog come back, or how do you deal with that?
I would have said we've never had that happen, but we did one instance. We had a veteran with some fairly serious physical problems and had a continuation of surgeries and physical issues that came along with that, pneumonia. He voluntarily surrendered the dog back to the program, and then the dog was placed with another soldier. It was still young enough that it could be placed with another soldier. So that ended up being a very successful placement after all. And obviously, as soon as that soldier's medical issues are resolved, we're going to provide him with another service dog.
Well, you said that, you know, one of the reasons you're in this is because of your love of the animals as well, right, as the love of the veterans. You know, you go to a shelter, you evaluate a number of dogs and bring them to train them. The ones that wash out of training, what happened to those?
Well, they're a high-priced commodity. These dogs are typically, and when I say typically, I mean always, when a dog washes out of the program, it's because it can't stay focused for what we call working focused for 3 hours. So the vest goes on, and for a three-hour period of time, the dog has to stay working focused. And sometimes that's challenging for dogs to stay, you know, on point for that long. And when those dogs can't do that, they're then adopted out, which, you know, generally go within days because we have volunteers, people that already know the dog. And so you're getting a 100% fully trained service dog. It just can't stay focused long enough.
I want to remind everyone, this I am Jeff Humfeld, and this is Jaws of Justice Radio, and we are talking with Joe Jeffers of Warrior's Best Friend today. I'll move to the next page here. How often are you able to pair a dog and a veteran together? In other words, how many veterans have you been placing? You say this year you're trying to do a dozen is your goal?
Our goal this year is 12. I do think that we'll probably be closer to 14. Our ultimate goal, we have a training facility that we're planning to start construction on in 2018. And so just, you know, another 12 months here. In that facility, we'll be able to house about 90 dogs at any one time. That'll allow us to place close to 72 dogs a year. So that would ultimately be our goal. I don't think that we would ever want to exceed that simply because of the quality aspect of what we're doing. It's certainly not the price club. You don't push them through as fast as you can.
You know, with that kind of an expansion, I would think that you will be looking for those people that want to work with the animals. Uh-huh. And at some time, I don't know whether it's a paid position or whether it's voluntary or whatever, but, you know, there's an awful lot of people out there that I've talked with that have worked in shelters, and especially the ones that do put the dogs to sleep, that just they can't handle that and all. And this sounds like a really good opportunity for people who want to care for the dogs.
Right.
And be involved in that. That down the road, there's a really good opportunity for them to be involved.
At our full capacity, at 72 placements a year, we're going to need, well, I would say somewhere around 8 trainers. Now, right now, we have 2. One of our second one is an apprentice who went through our program and received a service dog, and he loved it so much he wanted to help other veterans, and so Michael is an apprentice with our organization, and he is pretty much fully trained. So we've got another class that's coming through in June, and Michael will be leading the training the soldiers for that class. So we're pretty excited about that. That will be his first solo. But eventually we will need another 6 to 8 more trainers. Yeah.
Are there... is there like there is a training curriculum? Do you train your own trainers, so to say, or is yeah. there some place that other people can go, you know, to get this training?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think a lot of folks think that, you know, having previous training skills would probably put you in a better position to become a trainer, say, for our program. Typically, training organizations, when it comes to service dogs, like to hire and train their own trainers without skill. Every training organization has its own techniques, processes, and it's generally works better if we take individuals without absolutely no training experience, but just a passion for animals, and then train them to teach the dogs, instruct the dogs the way that we do.
All right, your website is real interesting, and we're going to mm-hmm. give that website here in just a minute or two. But you have a lot of pictures of the dogs. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of pictures of the veterans with them. You follow cases. You know, you highlight particular veterans and dogs and mm-hmm. and highlight what's going on with them during training and then afterwards too. You know, is that something that you plan to continue doing that with as many as you can? Or
we do. I think that there are several things that are really unique about our organization. One, all of our dogs, 100% of our dogs are shelter dogs, homeless dogs, which is incredibly unusual. 95-98% of training organizations in the United States use only bred dogs. I would say one of the most interesting things about our organization is the way that we go to the extent that we document the process, not just the dogs as they leave the shelter and they go through the process becoming a service dog. We videotape their progress and their training so that the public can view and understand how that process works. But it's wonderful to see the end story, which is, you know, which is what we all want, is for a veteran to have the love and passion of this animal and be able to continue forward in their job, going back to school, those kinds of things. So we document that process when the soldier shows up here. We videotape. Typically, we do about 8 videos of them working with the dog while they're here for 9 days. And we publish those on our website so that a lot of people take interest in a particular dog and they want to kind of see who it gets paired with. And then they really enjoy seeing the soldier work with the dog and learn how to handle the dog. And then almost all of our soldiers end up providing updates. They like to stay connected. And so that's always fun. Yeah.
All right. I want you to tell folks how they would get a hold of you, you know, if they're interested in volunteering or donating or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. they can do to help this process. How would they contact Warrior's Best Friend?
Sure. Well, the best resource is to go to our website. On our website, you'll find an application. If you are a candidate for a service dog or needing a service dog, you can go on our website. There is an application and good instructions on how to go through the process. We also have a section on there for volunteers to fill out a form. We accept volunteers to walk dogs, play with dogs, even potentially end up being a trainer. But as far as the 800 number and our email, We answer those daily, so feel free to go to our website, and you should find every resource that you need there.
Okay, and that website is warriorsbestfriend.org. Warriorsbestfriend.org. The email is pretty similar to that. It's hello at warriorsbestfriend.org. You said a 800 number. I didn't notice an 800 number. I do have a local number. The 816 number is 429-6305. That's 429-6305, and that is an 816 number. You remember what the 800 number is?
I don't know, Alfan. No.
Okay. Well, I'll look for that.
I've got a fax number. I can't remember either.
Yeah, we will put that up on our website and also include that through the Facebook page for Jaws of Justice Radio. Why don't you tell us a little bit? Why don't you kind of give us an idea of who it is that you work with? We already talked about the VA, but are there other other places?
Well, we here in Kansas City, we work exclusively with Great Plains SPCA. They're a fantastic organization, and most of our service dogs we're able to find through them. They're very helpful in identifying candidates, and so we do much of that. We also work with Operation Kindness in Dallas, Houston SPCA, and to find additional dogs. And then, of course, the VA in Leavenworth, Kansas City, and Topeka. We have another one in Rapid City, Iowa, that we work with as well. But through that, and then through just individuals, parents, loved ones calling, we're able to find all of our veterans that way.
Well, I want to thank you, Joe Jeffords of Warrior's Best Friend, for coming on today, and we'll have you back sometime when you've got that new facility all put together. We want to end our broadcast today with the 420 Drug War News with Dean Becker, and today he's talking with Michael Krawitz, Director of Veterans Medical Cannabis Access.
It's the 420 Drug War News. This past weekend, I was in Berkeley, California, attending the Patients Out of Time Conference, medical cannabis advocates gathering of scientists and doctors. I got a chance to speak with Mr. Michael Krawitz. He's the director, Veterans for Medical Cannabis.
Dean, how you doing?
I'm well, sir. It's good to be back, kind of like old home week here, is it not?
It is. It really feels like family. The advocates that you get to know over the years, working on so many projects together, it feels great to get to see them.
Now, you know, we have the scientists coming, we have the doctors, we got the authors, we got the lawyers, we've got the top dogs, if you will, examining and directing our nation's policies or understanding about marijuana. Give us a summary of what you're bringing to this conference, would you, Michael?
Well, the thing that I'm working on is veterans advocacy and veterans coordination. And right now, we've got probably the highest number of veterans organizations working on medical cannabis access that I've ever seen. And we had a meeting last night. Weed for Warriors put together a little gathering, and we're going to have another veterans more stakeholder meeting and activist kind of strategy session on Sunday. So this is sort of a sub-theme of the conference here, working with veterans and veterans advocacy. And recognizing that veterans as a community are very much in need of cannabis as a medicine to help them break the cycle of abuse of opiates and overdose, and even to help with lowering suicide rates.
Yeah, 22 a day I keep hearing, and it's unacceptable indeed, Michael. We veterans deserve much better. I'm going to keep quiet. It's a very touchy subject, isn't it, Mike?
Well, I think it's important for people to understand what we're talking about here. And we're not just talking about, okay, cannabis is great, you know, give it to vets. And we've actually got science that shows that if you allow patients to have access to cannabis, let's say as a pain medicine, they're going to use less of these pills, the opiate pain medications, and that very logically leads to less opiate overdose and less death. And the same thing with post-traumatic stress. We've been working on that as a qualifying condition under state laws, and we found the same thing where veterans are telling us they're getting a better result using cannabis as an adjunct and using a lot less of these pills. And together with other treatments that are available at the VA, I think cannabis is just an effective tool that's kind of missing from their toolbox.
It's still, in essence, reefer madness. It's clinging to hysteria of the past that something horrible might happen if this were to be allowed. Your response to that, Michael?
Well, in a way, it's kind of the past fighting the future, but I would word it a little differently. What we've got here are a lot of officials, like, let's say, the Attorney General of the United States, you know, Attorney General Sessions. These are individuals that their entire concept and memory of marijuana is, you know, a handful of people with signs outside, you know, trying to legalize marijuana, you know, back in the 1960s or something like that. And you know, we stand by that. Those are our people. We're not ashamed of our activist past, but we've grown and changed so much since then based on the evidence, based on the information that we've gained through science. And ironically, a lot of it paid for by the U.S. federal government. But heck, they're not taking any of this into consideration. They're not taking it seriously. They're just dismissing it as just wild-eyed claims of potheads. And, you know, heck, we've had some great wild-eyed claims, you know, of our potheads, but this isn't one of them. This is hard science. The National Academies of Science, the Institute of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, these are the kind of things that we're referencing these days. It's not high times.
Look, the heck of it is if I understand right, our northern neighbors already have medical marijuana. They're fixing to legalize marijuana outright. Our southern neighbors, Mexico, I think, just voted to legalize medical, and they're considering legalizing it outright as well. A couple of these United States, the legislatures are teetering on the brink of legalizing more outright marijuana. History's just not going to be kind to those who cling too long to these ancient creeds.
I think that's true, but I think it's also true, there's a kind of a general thing, a general truth that's emerged, that the more you resist a rational change, the more that you prevent, you know, regular kind of common sense reforms, the more radical that change is when it finally happens. And that's the irony of the people that are clinging too hard to the past, clinging too hard to these prohibition policies. They're the ones that are really causing some of the most liberal policies to become enacted through their resistance.
You can hear more from Michael and many other cannabis experts by tuning in to the most recent Cultural Baggage. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.